Early to bed, early to rise, eat right and advertise. Early to bed, early to rise. And one more thing, get your name out there.
So this week we are delighted to welcome Ari Paparo to the program. Ari is a well-known influencer, blogger, fellow podcast host, and serial entrepreneur. He's worked at DoubleClick, AppNexus, and Nielsen, and he was CEO and co-founder of Beeswax, which was acquired by Comcast Freewheel Division in 2020. Ari co-founded Marketecture.tv in 2022, and he just recently launched another company called Launch Signs. So we have heard that entrepreneurship runs in your family, Ari. You've written about your father. It seems like quite a character. What did he do exactly?
Well, I don't think that's safe for this podcast, but let's just say he was involved
in many... What was his career?
He was very busy, man. He was involved in many entrepreneurial activities. He had some background in the garment center, but I think when I was growing up, especially as a teenager, it was a constant conversation in our family about businesses and business opportunities, many of which were fairly ridiculous in retrospect. My father, if you search for my last name on the patent databases, you'll probably find my father, Michael Paparo, who as a patent holder for French toast on a stick. The trick
which sounds
is that
delicious.
It does. And you could buy it in the freezer case and I do not get a royalty. Trick is that you can't really patent the French toast itself. You can't patent the stick, but you can patent the application of the French toast to the stick and the method by which it adheres. And that is my family legacy.
Well, was he really an uncredited producer on Frampton Comes Alive?
Yes, he was. He owned a small venue in Nassau County, Island Music Center. It was Frampton Comes Alive was partially recorded there, and he was involved in that.
So yes. Your childhood, Ari, I mean, did you move around a lot? Was it chaotic?
Yeah. Chaotic.
What was it like?
No, I'm from New York City. I grew up in Manhattan, lived in Manhattan almost my whole life. Yeah. It was like many children of entrepreneurs, I would say it was not chaotic, but there were changes over time. There were fat times and lean times.
When he was at the peak, so you know the big money, was it like a wealthy household? Did you have...
No.
Bentley SUVs running around?
Absolutely not. No. My mother is still with us. It lives across the street from me, actually. She worked in a flower shop, and we had a pretty modest lifestyle.
So then you, little Ari, went off to college. And what did you do there, Ari? What were your dreams?
I went to Georgetown sort of by accident. I'm not Catholic and I'm not really interested in politics for a professional perspective. I majored in marketing, which is a bit strange. I had most people don't know this, I had a minor in fine arts, so oil painting, some visual arts background. So it was a really interesting experience. I was a real techie, so I went to a math science high school. So when I went to Georgetown, which has not a tech bone in its body, I like to think the positive side of it, which is I got my liberal arts education, learned how to write, learned how to think, et cetera, which goes along with the more technology stuff that I learned in high school.
Well, as an ed tech entrepreneur, you are known as a writer also, so which is not a common attribute for an ed tech entrepreneur.
I'm not sure how I developed it, but I can write very quickly, probably faster at quality than almost any other person I've met. Just can pound out copy. If you need like a content marketing, you want a blog post about why your product's slightly better than the competition, I can do that in my sleep.
You did famously write a column for Ad Exchanger about cookie deprecation in the very beginning of 2020, I believe that was, right away, like within minutes. And people were wondering how that was possible. So I want to ask you, Ari, how did you get it out so fast?
Yeah, it's a funny story. Basically, I had some reporters call me or some reporters emailed me and they said things like, oh, big Google news tomorrow coming out. Do you have an opinion? I didn't know what it was. But I had like two or three reporters say that. I just figured it out. I knew what was happening. I knew Chrome was going to get rid of cookies. I just guest. And so I had some time to like kind of think it through. And then when the announcement actually happened, like at noon of that day, I just sat in front of my computer and banged out 1,000 words in like literally half an hour. So I sent it over to AdExchanger. I was like, hey, do you want to run this? And they were shocked. They didn't know what to do. They were like, where did this come from? How do you know? I was like, I don't know. I just kind of guessed.
And also it was, must be said, probably the most popular column in AdExchanger history, I would guess.
They've told me that for a couple of years, I was the number one column like several years in a row. Yeah. Because I also wrote kind of for the first time, I wrote this article about like, it was called like the programmatic waterfall mystery. And it was one of the first articles that really talked about the impact of header bidding because it was just happening and no one understood what was happening. And I didn't understand what was happening. So I wrote an essay explaining why I was confused. And that was their number one article for that year.
I was very proud in 2018, I believe. I did edge you out just very briefly. That was probably the peak moment of my career.
But, well, you're known for your fantastic presentations. I don't have that theatrical style.
A new original series about a hotshot management consultant.
At any rate, so going back to the 90s, when we were both younger men. So I've heard that you founded a .com called blink.com. Did that make you very wealthy like everyone else in the 90s?
Yeah, the 90s, great time. You know, it's funny. You know, there's a real big difference between your podcast and mine, which is you seem to have a research budget. I just make mine up when I get on the microphone.
There's no budget, Ari, for really anything.
My 90s experience, just a quick snapshot of what life was like before the internet. I left Georgetown, did a startup that was pre-internet. So it was a startup involving fax machines and documents called Fran Data, which was a franchise information service, which collected information about franchises and syndicated that data. Then I worked at a company that also, you're not going to believe this company existed. It was called Find SVP. And it was literally a service where you can call them up on the phone, get in touch with an expert like me. So it was a switchboard that would go to the expert and ask questions like, how many McDonald's are there in America? And I would then look it up and tell you.
That's the SVP?
This existed. SVP was Souvenir because it was a French company. So this was the American franchise of this French company that invented this concept. And people would pay thousands of dollars a month for the SVP card that would allow them to ask experts questions on facts about the world, because the internet did not exist. The thing you're referring to is a startup I did after business school called blink.com. It was online bookmarking. So we took your bookmarks or your favorites from your browser, put them in the cloud, synced them across devices, enabled you to annotate them and share them as a research tool.
Oh, yeah. That was really hot back then. Bookmarking.
It was kind of hot. Yeah. There were a couple companies that did it. We raised a lot of money. I teamed up with a bunch of folks who had a finance background. And it turns out that there was a pretty small market of people who really cared. And there was a pretty big market of people who like sort of knew what bookmarks were, but didn't really want to engage with them very much. So the company was sold for not a profit. And then interestingly, I bought back the valuable part of the business, which was the paid bookmarking service for people who really cared, and ran that for years, just, you know, as a service people paid for and charged their credit cards and, you know, kept doing that until they had traded out.
Did that pay for your vacations, family vacations?
Okay. It was a nice, very small, but nice stream of money.
So do you recall where you were during the dot-com crash and what that emotional experience was like for you?
I think the day the dot-com crash started for me was when the Barron's article came out. The headline was about Dr. Koop, and the Barron's article basically said, this company is going to go out of business in months. And it was publicly traded at the time because they were just burning so much money, it had no cash. And then they went on to list public companies whose cash burn would put them out of business within a year. And people read that article and just totally freaked out.
Understandably.
So I was, at the time, you know, I was an executive at this privately held cash burning company that made very little revenue. And I was like, huh, that's not great. I wonder how this is going to play out.
But you had gone to business school, so you had marketable skills, obviously, as an MBA.
Arguable, sure.
So then how did you make your way over to DoubleClick? Because DoubleClick was founded in 1994 and 1995, and it had gone through ups and downs, and then it was acquired by Private Equity. And at what stage were you a DoubleClicker?
Yeah. So I was a DoubleClicker. I think I may have joined at the Nader. Like on the work of DoubleClick is the day I joined. Yeah. So it wasn't yet a part of a private equity firm. It's still publicly traded. The stock was like at $6. And that also means I actually made money on the DoubleClick exit to the private equity firm. I'm like the only person that made money on that because I'm the only one whose strike price was so low. My DoubleClick interview story is kind of hysterical. Yeah. So I was, you know, it was a dot-com bust. I was sort of doing a lot of freelance consulting, this and that. There were very few jobs out there. I got connected for this job and they brought me in. And it went from like one interview, two interviews. Hey, can you stay all day? We have a lot of people who want to meet with you. And I was like, okay, sure. At the end of the day, they're like, so if we made you an offer, would you start? And I was like, I'd consider it. And then they said, would you start Monday? And it was Friday at the time. I was like, I'd consider it. and the product I was applying to run was this godforsaken product called Dart Motif. So Dart obviously was the brand name for all the DoubleClick products. Motif was their answer to Point Roll and iBlaster. It was their rich media. I think I told the story on my podcast, but basically Kevin Ryan, the CEO, had publicly said as a public company, he was so excited about Motif, he thought it'd be a $20 million business that year. And so it was July when this interview was happening. And I said to one of the interviewers, like, how close are you that $20 million target? And they brushed me off. They didn't answer. Right. So I start Monday. Yeah. I start Monday and I'm trying to collect information to learn about this product I'm running. And I said, so how much revenue have we generated in the first 6 months of this $20 million year? And they said about $76,000. and by the way, that customer who paid the $76,000 is never going to use it again. They had a horrible experience. So I started on Monday. On Friday of that week, my boss quit and said, like, I'm done. Here's the keys to the cars.
Who was running the company then? Was it Rosenblatt yet? Or was it?
No, it was Kevin Ryan. Kevin O'Connor had already retired to surf on the West Coast.
West. Yeah.
Yeah. KR was running it. Rosenblatt didn't pick up until the private equity acquisition.
Okay. So what, I mean, you said it was sort of the nadir. This was a rebuilding phase. So what was the company actually like? Like, was it empty? Were there tumbleweeds going down the corridor? Or was morale good? Were you fighters?
It was bad. It was really bad. It was really bad.
People remembered the good times with sadness.
Yeah, there was a lot of people there who had been there in the good times and now were just like weighing their options, trying to figure out their next step in their lives. Like, how did I get here? So the two core pieces of the business, DFA and DFP, were both pretty substantial businesses that had no innovation whatsoever. They're stagnant. They're milking the customers for money. They were overpriced, which was a real issue. So even though they were dominant, they were wildly overpriced compared to the competition, and they were losing share. Meanwhile, the company, especially the top execs, had invested quite a bit of money in mergers and acquisitions, but also in build on various non-advertising related plays. So they basically expanded horizontally email was the biggest one. Dartmail was what it was called. They bought Performix for search. They had marketing automation tools. They had, quite a bit of sprawl in the product line. And those other businesses were all suboptimal, substandard compared to the competitive market. And the senior execs were pretty distracted because they were running this portfolio of, mature and new products, all of which were troubled. And it was pretty bleak.
You did recently, under the Marketecture umbrella, have released a podcast called An Oral History of DoubleClick, which I commend to everyone, and I'll put a link in the show notes here. So when you recorded that, you were recording with some of your old colleagues, people you knew, and then others. Was there anything that came out of that recording, that oral history, that surprised you, that you didn't know already?
There were a number of milestones from the time I joined through the Google acquisition. Yeah. One of the big milestones was that we signed AOL moving them to the DoubleClick stack was a huge win, huge milestone. And it really was a bit of a distraction because it pulled engineering resources and product resources from all over the company to help support them. And when I was talking to my former colleague, Jonathan Bellick, about it, I offhandedly said, you know, it was amazing because they were the biggest customer. And he said, no, they were not the biggest customer. They thought they were the biggest customer and acted like it, but actually eBay was the biggest customer, which I do kind of remember in hindsight. But yeah, DoubleClick had a lot of customers and a lot of different configurations who wanted all kinds of stuff. And that's kind of one of the reasons why it was so difficult to manage at the time.
DoubleClick was acquired by private equity. And then in 2008, Google came in and bought it. Obviously, it had turned itself around.
It was a masterful management job in terms of taking this sprawling, messy company and fixing it as fast as possible. A lot of that had to do with doing things quickly that probably were very difficult to do as a public company. So in short order, like within the first 4 months, I say, after it was taken private, we shut down a bunch of money-losing businesses in Europe. We sold the entire mail business, which was a very large piece of the company. We shut down certain product lines. We reorganized the engineering team to be agile and effective when it had been waterfall and very ineffective. Yeah. Escalated some people into more important management positions, de-escalated others. We bought two competitors. So in the DFP business, bought Falk, which was the leading competitor to DFP. And in my business, DoubleClick Rich Media, we bought a company called Clipmart, which was the kind of the most innovative video-centric rich media company. And both of those just had huge effects on, you know, everything from revenue to growth, et cetera. So it was very fast. We got all of this done. And then the second shoe dropped, which was, you know, Brian O'Kelly over at Right Media invented the ad exchange. Yeah. And that had an obvious multiplier effect on the DoubleClick business because we already had all these publishers with their inventory. And Scott Spencer and Michael Rubenstein, who were two executives at the company, were put in charge of creating the DoubleClick ad exchange. And the rest is history.
I see. So the Right Media works into this story as well, which was came out of Sonar. Some of the original employees came out of Sonar, which was a DoubleClick media business.
Right Media was like a shadow competitor where DoubleClick really didn't go head to head with them ever. There were different types of customers and use cases, but we saw them. They were also in New York, and we were getting worried about what was happening over there. They were growing very fast, and Yahoo invested in them, and they had innovated in ways we were not innovating. We had to do something about that.
So there was acquisition, and then you did work at Google for a little bit. How long were you there?
About 2 years.
So why did you end up leaving?
Google is fundamentally an engineering company, yeah, and I'm not an engineer. I often say this is kind of a funny thing, and a lot of entrepreneurs have this weird personality trick, which is I like earning money more than having money. Right. I like the pursuit of money. I don't actually care if I have the money or not. I don't spend it on
that. That is very entrepreneurial. Yeah.
Right. And so my choice was I could sit at Google and make a, you know, ungodly amount of annual salary, sure, for doing nothing, or I could do something more interesting.
So then you did wend your way over to Nielsen, where you accomplished some wonderful things. Is that your next step in life?
It was, unfortunately. Okay. That was definitely a career misstep. I looked around, had a bunch of offers, mostly startup type things. And the Nielsen job really sounded good on paper. It was really head of digital, doing all kinds, running the whole product group. And it turns out that Nielsen doesn't have any products, right? The word product is a misnomer for what Nielsen has. Yeah. It has data and people who sell the data. And then there's some people in between who are called product leaders, but I would not call them product managers. I mean, they're nice people. If you're listening, sure, to this, I respect you as product managers, but your job at Nielsen was not to manage products. I was there for 6 months. I did one thing of note, which was that I'm the patent holder on DAR, OCR, whatever you want to call it. Me and Minock teamed up with a team at Facebook and created that concept of using anonymized cohorts of users to create ratings. And it's still used to this day. So that was something.
So this leads us to Beeswax, which you've co-founded in 2015. So not long 2014. After your 2014. Yeah. Oh, even better. What was your dream there? And I know beeswax was, you said bitter as a service. I was working at Gartner at the time, and you said, oh, bitter as, I'd never heard that phrase before, bitter as a service. So I suppose maybe you were the pioneer there.
Bitter as a service, trademark.
There you go.
Yes. So I like to explain it in different ways. It really did come out of my time at AppNexus. So we kind of skipped over some time I spent at AppNexus. If you look at AppNexus back in that day, it was its positioning and its reality were different. The positioning was, we're the tech platform you build on to execute your advertising business, right?
Yeah.
Which I loved. I love that positioning. I was a real enthusiast of that positioning. I believe, and I don't want to be insulting to AppNexus, but I believe they underperformed versus their ambition because the product didn't really do that. It was too hard to use. The API documents weren't updated. There weren't test environments. They didn't run the company like they were a platform. They ran it like they were a DSP or an SSP.
Managed service.
Managed service back then, but yeah. And so so especially on the buy side, which I've always been more of a buy side guy, I identified as a group of customers who really wanted to own their own bidder or own their own DSP, however you want to say it, but didn't want to spend $100, $200 million to buy one. And they didn't want to spend $5 or $10 million of cash flow to build one. There was an opportunity, and AppNexus wasn't really doing it. And the Trade Desk had APIs, but you really couldn't use it like it was your own DSP. And so we created this unique architecture that allowed customers to have their own instance of the bidder. So it was separate code per customer within our cloud, and customize it quite a bit to meet their business needs. And we sold it like it was software. So it was a flat fee ranging from, about 10 grand a month up to, 100 grand a month for the service. Yeah. Compared to percentage of media, it's quite cheap. You spend $1 million on media on the Trade Desk and their average take rate is 20%. That's $200,000 a month. So we were a lot cheaper than the Trade Desk.
Yeah.
Right. But we were predictable.
Was it hard to sell in the beginning? Did you go to ad networks to sell the bidder as a service, or was it brands?
Yes. In our angel deck, the deck we used to raise angel funds, we said the following. There's two different markets. The first market is ad networks and media companies who want to use a bidder to execute their media business plan. And the actual advertiser is somebody else downstream. This isn't arbitrage. This is execution of IOs through a bidder. And then the second market is brands direct, who are too sophisticated for your average DSP. They want code level control. They have data scientists in-house. They want to integrate with, CRM systems, etc. And then what happened was, we were right about the first group. We were really right. We understood them. We sold to them. We grew very rapidly. VCs would look at our deck and say, wow, you're really growing fast. Like, this is amazing, this business. Yeah. And then we were totally wrong about the second group. The brand direct.
I could have told you that.
Yeah. A lot of people told a lot. Well, the thing is, as an entrepreneur, everyone tells you all of course, everything they think about everything, and they're wrong half the time. So you have to choose which half you believe. So what happened was, and we discussed this on my podcast on architecture just like 2 weeks ago, which is, it's not that in-housing didn't happen. In-housing did happen, but the priorities for in-housers were ease of use, central control. Which both favored Google enormously. Most companies that in-house and signed DSP contracts direct went to Google, some went to Trade Desk, some went to MediaMath. Very few ended up going to Beeswax.
So there was a company out there since acquired called IP on Web, and you competed with them, right? How did you distinguish yourself from?
Yeah. IP on Web had two businesses. They have a bidder that they license, and then they had a stream of inventory called BidSwitch, which is still in play. And then they did custom development. We were directly competitive with their bidder. And I would say it's not an exaggeration to say we beat them so thoroughly that business disappeared.
Were you just easier to use, or what was
everything was better about it? Our solution was better in every way than their bidder. Like, it was, their bidder was custom software that was very expensive. They had to have an account team in Russia build any feature you wanted. We had our pricing on our webpage. You can sign a contract with us and be live in 3 days. We had APIs that were all documented. We were cheaper. And we effectively, anytime a company wanted a bidder, like they actually wanted a bidder, we would win.
Get your name out there.
So then what was it that Comcast saw in you It was Comcast Freewheel, so it's on the video side.
I think there's a couple of things. One is that over time, our business became overwhelmingly video. It was not intentional. We supported video pretty well. We did a good job on video. The growth in these media businesses was largely video-centric. So the types of companies who wanted bidders often were in the video world. And also, other businesses like mobile app were too hard, and people were going out of business pretty rapidly if they're intermediaries in that business. So that was the first thing. So if you think of us as just a video DSP with a lot of volume going through it, the synergies with the rest of Freewheel are pretty obvious, I think. They were actually really against programmatic because most of their customers were these giant media companies who hated programmatic. And so they reflected that. But what they one thing they did do pretty successfully before they bought their way into programmatic years later was that they allowed their customers to trade inventory with each other. So media companies, local TV companies, and broadcast TV companies and cable companies, they all have the ability to swap inventory with each other in Freewheel. And I think this is sort of a natural evolution of that being beeswax technology.
You worked for Comcast for a bit, right?
1 year. Exactly.
Yeah.
I felt like I owed it to the customers and the employees to spend some time there, even if it wasn't really needed.
So Beeswax as a company, where was Beeswax HQ? Did you guys have a central nexus?
Yeah, we were in New York before COVID. The funny thing is we had a sublease and our landlord was Freewheel. And that was just a funny coincidence. So we were on 7th Avenue and 26th Street. It was a great office. Everyone who went there, it was just an unbelievably nice office.
Really? What was your secret? What made it so
having
wonderful?
A nice office?
Yeah.
It just had incredible views in all directions. It turns out that the biggest source of leads for the company Beeswax, by far, was my personal LinkedIn account.
Hashtag we go hard. Hashtag and we can't stop. Hashtag
we won't stop.
Hashtag we run this.
Hashtag true players for life.
Hashtag is it worth it or let me work?
The vast majority of our good customers came in because someone on LinkedIn was like, hey, dude, can you give me a bidder? And I was like, yeah, sure. Give me your email. And I'd send them to one of the salespeople. And the sales process was still hard. They earned their money. But the marketing, we never got marketing right other than just brand awareness. Like the direct response stuff in marketing, our CMO, Paul Knetson, did a great job. But like it was just impossible. It was hard.
So speaking of social networks, continue to be what we would call an influencer, at least in the industry. How did you make that happen? Do you have a strategy or is it just natural?
I love Twitter from the minute it was invented. I was, I was tweeting. I didn't have a giant following. I was whatever. I was just tweeting about stuff. And then sort of Business Insider in the early days, before it became Insider and before it had a paywall, when it was just like, Nick and the rest of those guys trying to figure it out. For some reason, I became friendly with them and they started writing about me like in ways that were funny. And they did this article called like 10 Googlers you should know or 10 Googlers you've never heard of. And they had me in there and they showed this picture of me and they were like, he's smart but low level or something like that. And then they decided to hang out in the Starbucks below Google and just like live blog what they saw of Googlers walking in and getting Starbucks. So I said, fuck it. And I went downstairs to the Starbucks and confronted them. And I was like, low level. What the hell are you talking about?
Low level and, insights? What? Low level.
And they thought it was the funniest thing ever. And they wrote a whole article about me, about how I confronted them in the Starbucks. And it turned into a long-term love-hate relationship between me and Business Insider, which then turned into a huge amount of Twitter following because they would like list me as like top 10 follows in advertising. They wanted to put me in the top 100 best Twitter accounts, right? Like number 18 behind Rupert Murdoch or something crazy like that. And my Twitter, and I, once you have critical mass, once you have like 5,000 followers, the rest sort of happens. My Twitter account is a very strange thing because I do feel like there are fewer and fewer people on Twitter. It's becoming less influential, even though it has a pretty high follower count.
It still does. So what about other networks? Are you on TikTok? You are on LinkedIn, obviously, but
LinkedIn, frankly, has better bang for the buck than any other social network for announcing things, getting conversations going. And now I have a media company. I'm creating podcasts and videos. So I think
I was going to ask you about your show business career. So you have Marketecture TV and what's that experience like? This is you as a media mogul.
Yeah, so I left Comcast and I wanted to do some startups, one or two. And I am doing a startup that has nothing to do with ad tech, right? We could talk about that. It's called Launch Science. And I'm pretty excited about that idea. But at the same time, I said to myself, it's pretty stupid to throw out 20 years of deep experience in ad tech. Like, am I just going to be a SaaS guy moving forward and never talk about ad tech again? That seems silly.
Seems wrong.
It seems wrong. So I was like, okay, how can I turn that into something beyond like a Substack? So I had this idea, which was sort of reaggregating myself and other experts into a media company about ad tech. And so I brought together Zach Rogers as our editor in chief, Eric Suford, who's probably the leading expert in mobile advertising, is a contributor, Mike Shields, who's an amazing contributor in TV, and a friend of mine, Jeremy Kagan, who's a professor of marketing. And we all go in and we do in-depth interviews of vendors and CEOs and find out, like, what are they really selling? Like, what beyond the BS, what does it really do? And then we put it behind a paywall. So you can get it for free, 5-minute clips, 7-minute clips, plus my weekly podcast. But if you want the good stuff, you know, you have to pay $30 a month, which is more than reasonable.
And on one of the really good ones, you did talk to me. So if anyone wants to know about
that, was excellent. That was excellent. CDP. I had a cold at the time, so I was like sneezing, coughing while I was talking to you. But it was an excellent interview. You did a great job.
Charming as always. So finally, Launch Science. This is, as you said, not related to ad tech, but what is it? I imagine it's got something to do with science and launching.
It really came out of my DoubleClick experience. It is related. So anyone who's worked at DoubleClick will hear the word readiness and they'll get PTSD, because readiness was the process that was used to make sure things launched properly. And it was basically a really long checklist with a really boring weekly meeting. And you'd go over and say, did you send the email to this person? Did you get legal approval? Have you written the headlines? You know,
this is for new product launch.
New product launches. Yes.
Yeah,
so,
okay.
So what I've learned, having worked at several large companies and interviewed, call it 25 to 30 product marketing leaders, is that this is a broken process, that every launch at every company is done from scratch. There's no tooling. So people are using Excel or maybe Asana or something like that. But there's no tooling specific to this problem. That executives are very frustrated. They don't know what's being launched when, except for the really big ones, that maybe once a year, but like on a day-to-day basis, they don't know what's happening. They don't feel prepared. They don't feel like their sales force is prepared. They don't feel like their customer success people are prepared. And I believe it's a solvable problem. So Launch Science is a new SaaS product that's currently in a closed beta. You can sign up for the wait list if you'd like. And it is meant to help primarily software companies, but really any kind of company, to more effectively commercialize and launch their new products and features.
So it's a workflow tool.
A workflow, document management. We have AI in it, so we can go from, let's say, Jira epics. You can pull in your Jira epics, use the AI to turn them into benefit statements and blog posts and press releases. It's a pretty robust set of tools that we're building.
Almost like a no-brainer. So closed beta. So literally just launched then. You must have done some fundraising. Did you have a round or anything?
Yeah, we did a pre-seed round last year, significant one. And so we're still iterating on the products, not ready for open availability yet. We're still getting feedback.
Do you have any salespeople?
No.
Thank you.
That's pretty much my Instagram feed is almost entirely baked goods. I do enjoy cooking a lot. I was baking a lot during the COVID year, and I do a lot less now that I'm, you know, in the work grind in Manhattan, but definitely enjoy it. Cook for my family.